Good morning. So, last time before the exam, which is graded, there's a key, there's some things that where I made some mistakes on questions, but figured out a way of grading them anyways, but please look at your exam and tell me if you think I'm grading it wrong. Preferably do this, like, not the last week of the semester. I will still look at things last week of the semester, but it really works out better if you tell me, like, in the next couple weeks. So last time, we were talking about virtual memory. So I'm going to do my quick re-review of virtual memory that we talked about last time, which I went through quickly because most of you have seen it before. I thought all of you have seen it before, but apparently I misunderstand our computer engineering program, which is interesting. Especially since this course has virtual memory management techniques in the catalog description. But we'll go through review. So we talked about page tables, which are a central structure in virtual memory. So we divide our memory up into fixed size chunks. This is both for the memory that programs see, called virtual addresses, and the memory that we really have in the system called physical addresses, and the page table maps these chunks from in our virtual space to our physical space, same size chunks. And it turns out the way we set up these chunks that we just change some of the high bits, and the table tells us how to do that. So the page table entries contain a physical page number, and we also use them to contain some bonus information, the most notable of which is that it has permission bits. It can say, hey, you, this page goes to this physical page, but if you're not in kernel mode, it shouldn't work. Or this page goes to this physical page, but if you're trying to write, it shouldn't work. We also talked briefly about two-level page tables, mainly because we're going to be dealing with XV6, which works on X86, which doesn't have one-level page tables, which is just a flat table. The table is a little more complicated because there's just too many pages to have one big table. That would just take up too much space, especially in the old days when we had like a gigabyte of memory total. We don't want each process having a megabyte list of page numbers. So they have a table of tables, and the first bits in your address tell you which first table to go to find the second table. The next bits tell you which second bit table to go to, and the last bits are actually what you use to access the physical page you find in the second level. So given that, we talked about specifically how these page tables work in XV6. So we talked about XV6's kernel memory layout, which apparently was a bit confusing, so I have a picture which might make this clearer. And also show some proportion issues that are maybe not so obvious. So in XV6, they've made this decision that this top part of memory here is going to be marking the page table as only works in kernel mode. But if you try to use it in user mode, yeah, there's a mapping, it's not going to work. Processor's going to say, sorry, the OS told me no. And there's this fixed mapping where this set of addresses up here maps to all the physical memory that's valid. It turns out that the way on the emulated machine that XV6 runs on, basically we have this amount of memory which we consider valid. We also have some memory up here, it turns out. That's really special, that we'll talk about later. And everything else we're not supposed to touch. So this is what the kernel uses, and these are most of the pointers that you see in the XV6 source code. So like if you have a pointer to a struct proc, it's a pointer to an address up here. So user space pages, user mappings, like this user stack and heap are down here, and they also map to the same physical places. Yes? Okay, yeah. So there are, in fact, for everything that you access in your user program, there are, in fact, two virtual addresses for it, only one of which you can use as an author of a user program. So XV6 has a bunch of page table manipulation functions, and we looked at some of them. And they mostly iterate through these tables, taking off the bits of the address to find the table entries to let the XV6 code that needs to set up page tables find a page table entry, set it to point to a particular physical page, and set its permission bits. And this can be used for all our tasks we need to do with changing the page tables, like allocating new pages, when a process calls sbreak, the function to change its heap size, and exacting processes where we create a whole new page table and need to initialize the page table and load the stuff that the process needs to start into physical memory and have the page table point to where we loaded that. We also started talking about two big page table, what I'll call tricks. And this is taking advantage of what page tables do if you don't have an entry. You can have holes in your page table, you can have entries where you just say it's not valid, there's nothing here. And if you try to access that, you'll get a page fault, an exception. The OS gets to run. And if the OS returns from the fault handler without changing anything about the program counter, it's going to redo the instruction that caused the fault. And this is actually a useful property because we can do things like allocate on demand. That when we have a page fault, we can say, okay, I'll make that work. I'll just fix the page table entry that was invalid and caused me to run, and I'll return, and you'll try again, and you'll see, oh, it's valid now, and you won't cause me to run again. And then you'll just proceed as if I had allocated it in advance. And we can also use this for copy on write, that we set a page read-only. And when there's a fault for it, because we marked it as read-only, and we said, so the processor said, you can't write to this, we make a copy, then we set the page table entry for it to point to the copy, and we return, so it's as if we wrote to the copy in the first place. And therefore, the program runs, as far as the program's concerned, as if it had a copy all the time, even though we waited until the last possible moment to make the copy. So any questions about any of these things on page tables before we move on to other topics? Okay. So, I'm going to focus a little bit of time reviewing these two tricks because we have an assignment about them. So we have our copy on write idea, which is that when we do a fork, we're not going to make a real copy. We're going to instead just copy our page table itself. So we have another page table which points to all the same stuff for the new process. And we're going to mark both of the page tables as all read-only. Then later on, the process is going to try to use this page table to write something. And the processor is going to say, no, you can't do that. The OS told me you can't write with that. So the OS gets to run because when the processor sees that, and the OS is going to say, okay, I know what I want to do here. I want you to be able to write, so I'm going to make it so you can write. And to do that, I'm going to fix the page table entry by changing where it points and making it write. And so you don't notice that I changed where it points. I'm going to copy the data when I do that. So we have it pointing somewhere. We're going to make a copy of that physical page, point to it, and make it writable. So questions on this? Some people look confused, so. So the question is, okay, so maybe I should label these page tables. So this is like our parent and our child. And writes to these page tables are going to work the same way. So if the program tries to, if the parent tries to write to this page table entry, it's going to do the same thing. We're going to make it writable and point to a new copy, you know, which let's say we allocate there, which will be in a different location because the parent and child have different memory. So we do it for both, we treat them both the same after we make the copy. And they'll both do this copy and write trick where if we try to write to something, they're supposed to have their own copy. We're pretending that they always had their own copy all along. And the way we're doing that is whenever we figure out, oh, you're writing and you shouldn't, you're supposed to have your own copy, we make your own copy. So other questions?
Does whichever one modify it get the copy, or does it always the child?
So the question is which one gets the copy. So whichever one modifies it first better get a copy, because we want to preserve it to be that if you read from it, you get what was supposed to be there based on when you forked. The simplest thing to do is you just always make a copy and deal with somehow getting rid of the original if there's no more references to it. So that would be the simplest solution. It was like here, I'm saying with what I wrote down is that I'm making a copy in both cases when they write to it, even though you might say, oh, but I could just keep the original for one of them. So obviously, it would be a good optimization to maybe keep the original if you observe, oh, no one else is pointing to it, but you don't have to do that. And the simplest thing is not to do that. Yeah.
How does the OS determine when it should do something during a page fault?
The question is, how does the OS determine when it should do something during a page fault? So we'll have possibly better answers for that, but let's go through sort of one thing you might do for implementing, say, allocating space on demand in XV6. So if you remember in XV6, we have this member of the struct proc called size, which says how much space does the process have? And if a process has a particular size, that tells us that in its layout, the size is in fact the size of this allocation down here, which I've drawn really small because it's usually really small. Usually there's a very small amount of memory compared to the total number of possible addresses. So what you might do in your page fault handler is you look at the address that triggered the page fault, and you say, okay, the program has size bytes from 0 to size allocated, that's its addresses, so I know that this is address 0, this is address size. I know that everything up here is invalid, so if it's in that region, I'm going to just kill the process. I'm going to say, sorry, you're accessing memory that you didn't allocate. Maybe it's the process, maybe it's the OS's memory, or maybe it's just in the blank space between the process's memory and the OS's memory. And if it's something else, I can say, okay, that should have worked, so I'm going to do whatever I need to do to make it work. Like, maybe I'm going to allocate a new page there if I wanted to add allocating on demand to XV6. And generally, the procedure is that we're going to have some sort of side data structure, like the size variable, telling us what regions of the program's memory are supposed to do what. And we'll see more about what that looks like in a bit. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so the reason I'm spending a lot of time on copy and write, one of the reasons, besides the thing it being a very important thing that that every modern OS does, is that we have a virtual memory assignment as released as of today, which is to add these two features to XV6. So allocating the heap on demand, just the heap, don't worry about the stack or loading the program directly. Which means on a page fault, you're going to do exactly that check of the address I showed you, and from the page fault handler, you know, it's going to look at that, and if it's okay, you're going to allocate the page, update the page table entry, and you're going to do this instead of allocating the heap pages when the program calls sbreak to change the size of its heap. You're just going to say, I'm going to guess you aren't going to use that right away, and then you're going to allocate it when it actually uses it. And this would allow the program to, for example, allocate a huge amount of heap space, and as long as it doesn't use the whole thing, it doesn't matter if it doesn't have enough memory for that. And that's how you, one example of how you test this is that after you do this, you should be able to allocate, like, you know, with sbreak, and I have an example program which does this, like 700 mega heap space, and as long as you don't touch the whole thing, it's fine. And also copy on write. So changing fork to keep the same page, and on a page fault, because a write was tried and it was read-only, copy and allocate a new page. And you need to, of course, get rid of the originals eventually. So the way I suggest doing that is keep a reference count for every page. The suggestion in the assignment is to literally just have an array for every single part of physical memory of how many references there are to it. Just a statically allocated array. And you just decrement the reference count. When it becomes zero, you say, okay, we're getting rid of it. There are some restrictions in this assignment to make it practical. So one big one is I don't care about handling page faults that are triggered by the kernel. So for example, you can call read, which reads into a buffer you pass in, which would write to the buffer from the kernel, which ordinarily you need to make copy and write work for. In this assignment, we don't care if that works. It's okay if that, in fact, doesn't work, even though it obviously should. But I only care about modifying memory from the user mode directly, not from system calls. And this is because if we didn't do this, you'd have to add support for handling page faults that are triggered by the kernel, which means not sending them to the same stack. So you can restore the other trap frame later on, which would be a lot more work. I don't think worth it. Also, to make it so you can reason about what I do in a fault handler, copy on write is going to be the only reason for read-only pages in user mode. And so that's going to mean that the way in your fault handler you can detect do I need to do copy on write is you just look up the page table entry with that walk page dir function we saw last time. You see, is it present and read-only? If so, you do copy on write stuff. And that should be read-only, obviously. So any questions on our assignments? This is my summary. The assignment has a lot of text on where to change things. In addition to the descriptions in the XV6 book about how it manages its memory. And it's due next week. Okay. So I'm sure there will be questions later on about the assignments. So I've talked about allocate on demand and copy and write, two nice tricks. So I'm going to talk about another trick that's not in the assignment, but it's implemented by every OS you know about. And this is what Unix calls mmap. So this is a function to map a file to memory. So you can open a file, get a file descriptor for it, and then you can call this function mmap and get a pointer, which is a pointer to the file's data. And this is not a read-only pointer. This is not a copy. This can be the actual file's data that you can write to, and it will write to the file. And when you write to that data, it writes to the file immediately. If you read from the file, you immediately see the update. There's no delay, no extra function you have to call. It just really is the file's data as far as you're concerned. So questions about this so far, besides that I'm not showing all the options to mmap yet?
So is this file in the sense that we think about files versus like text files or files versus like any kind of file, the terminal or?
So the question is, does this work for non-regular files like the terminal? And the answer is sometimes. It doesn't make much sense for something like the terminal. There are some types of non-regular files it will do something sensible for. But this is mostly for regular files, for normal files that there's data on disk, not something like a pipe. Because it's hard to imagine what's address 17 of a pipe. But it's easy to say what's byte 17 of a file, or in this case, you know, byte 7 or byte 6, starting from 0. And this is a way of getting at that. So mmap, this is the prototype for mmap. So I'll go through the important options. So it takes a length, a file descriptor, and an offset. And it says that we're going to give you access via your memory to length bytes from this file, which you just opened, so you have a file descriptor to point to it, and starting at byte offset of the file. You can also specify protection flags. So you can specify, do I want to read, write, or both? You can also map to make it executable. That is an option. And there's also an option for forcing segfaults, which turns out to be useful if you want memory that will always segfault. Which obviously you wouldn't do to read a file, but you might be helpful like if you're trying to make things easier to debug. So we specify where we want to access it. Then we have these flags, which are different than these protection flags. There's a bunch of flags. There's one is mandatory. You either need to specify shared or private. So if you specify shared, it does what I showed you earlier, that changing memory changes the file and vice versa. There's another mode, which is called private, which is that it makes a copy of the file data for you to access. And it's not a real copy, it's a copy on write copy. So this is a way to get at that same functionality we have for fork of making a copy only when we need it, but for files. There are also some additional flags, the most notable of which is this anonymous one that POSIX has, which is just ignores the file descriptor and just gives you a bunch of zeros. So you can also use this as a memory allocation function. And you might see some real uses of that, which is why I'm mentioning it, not because you'll use it that way. But the main use is that you can load a file into memory. If you specify shared, you can even write to the file. If you specify private, you can get a copy of the file loaded into memory that you can access. There's also an address argument, which is usually, and almost every time you'll see it, it's going to be null. It's a suggestion about where you'd like the mapping to be in your memory. It's a suggestion so the OS can say, I can't put it there, sorry. Typically people pass null and just say, decide for me someplace. So this function loads a file into memory, optionally a copy, so we can access it. And we can even specify that to be readable and executable or writable. Can anyone think of a common case in which we load files into memory? When we're running programs on our system, when's a case when we load files into memory? Yeah.
When
we're loading an executable. Yeah. And on Unix-like systems, this is the function that is used internally to load executables. So loading executable on something like Linux is just a whole bunch of nmap calls internally inside the kernel. It uses the exact same mechanism, and that's the reason why we have this private option. Because if you think about loading the initial values of like your global variables, we want to load that, and if we edit our global variables, we don't want to edit the executable, we want to edit a copy for our current global variables. And that's exactly what that's used for. And the way most Unix-like systems manage their memory is rather than keeping track of this is the size of your allocation like we saw in XV6, they keep track of a list of these mappings, a list of things created by calling memmap. And in fact, on Linux, there's a special file you can read which will show you a list of all these mappings for any process. It's called maps, and it's in /proc, and a PID maps will show you this file. So here, I'm looking at proc self maps. Self is a symlink for is the current process. And this is a list of, in this case, because I'm using cat, to look at it, all of cat's memory mappings. So this is unfortunately a table without column labels, so I'm going to go through what these things mean. So first, we have the range of addresses. So it's telling us that this range of addresses, hex 400000 to 40B000, is loaded from, it turns out, bincat. And that when the equivalent of mmap was done, it was done with the protection flags being readable and executable, not writable. And the P means it was done with map private. So it's copy on write. That's not actually relevant here because we can't write it. It's mapped as marked as not writable. This is read-only executable data, like this is where main is. This is how we loaded main. We mmapped it from bincat. And it's telling us it starts at offset 0 from the file bincat. So the next thing there is the offset in the file. And we also have this information on the file, this is a device, and item number. You don't know what those mean yet. We'll talk about what they mean when we talk about file systems. But it's information which identifies the file bincat. We'll talk about what it means when we talk about file systems, actually. So this is as if we did something like this. And this was done when exec was run by the kernel. Yeah?
When you're like opening a file just on your like UI and then editing it, is that just an mmap call with a map share?
So the question is, do text editors use mmap with map share? And the answer is usually no. Usually text editors use read and write instead. They could use mmap without shared, but they usually consider that more complicated for what they want to do. Mostly because text editors usually rewrite the whole file when you write it. And if you're writing a text editor, it turns out you want to keep the file in a data structure where you can easily add to the middle. And that's not easy to do if you just have an mmap copy of the file. You like need to move everything afterwards. That's kind of inconvenient. Okay, So let's, another view of this mapping is that we have a bunch of virtual pages which are mapped to the file when we call memmap. And I talked about that allocate on demand trick, and that's typically what modern operating systems do as a first approximation, so that they can do that trick. So you call mmap, they just record this entry inside the OS, and they just leave your page table all invalid. And they also do have the data for the file. So the data for the file is ultimately on disk, right? There's a copy of the file on our disk, or SSD, or whatever storage device we have. And the OS also is going to keep copies of the file data, and this is going to be true for every files, possibly cached in memory. It's going to have copies of important parts of files, recently accessed parts of files, to make things fast. That might not be the whole file. And let's say you try to read from part of this mapping. We're going to get a page fault. The page fault handler is going to run, and it's going to say, oh, you called mmap earlier. I remember it goes to this file. So I'm going to look up where can I get a copy of the data for that part of the file. And in this case, we're going to say, oh, I already have a copy of it in memory. Maybe some other program mapped it. Or maybe I just have it lying around and I never freed it. So I'm going to update your page table to point to that, return from my page fault handler, and your access is just going to work great. And let's say you access something else that I don't have loaded already. I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to look up that address you access, say it comes from this part of the file. And I say, do I have a copy of that loaded? No, well, I better do that for you. So I'm going to take it from disk, I'm going to load it into memory. And after that's done, I can finally update the page table entry to point to that page, return from the page fault handler, and you can go along your way. So this is the usual operation of loading executables on a modern system, that we actually load kind of on demand. Maybe if we're trying to be faster, we'll do set a bunch of page table entries at once. But our fallback case is that if you have a big executable, we'll load it as we need to, based on when you try to actually access it. So any questions about this? So this is just the read-only case, no copy on write, nothing fancy. So notice a property of this is that I have to keep track as the OS, not only that you called mmap earlier and that this page goes to this file, I also need to keep track of, for every file, where do I have cached copies of this? And this is a big thing that pretty much all modern OSs do with memory, is that if you have spare memory, what they're using it for is caching files. That they want to keep copies of files you've recently accessed, partly for mmap, they also use it for read, right? If you're reading from a file, you sure would like to use the copies I have shown here rather than loading it from disk, because it will be a lot faster. So this is a big thing OSs use memory for, and part of using that memory is that they need to have data structures tracking for every file, where are my cached copies of parts of it. Okay, so other questions? So that was the read-only case. So let's talk about the case where we do that shared flag. So the case I showed you originally for mmap where we could change the original file. We don't get a copy, we don't have a read-only version, we change the original file. So I could like make that by calling mmap something like this, and you see the mapping I get here that I have, the permissions are read, write, shared, which maps to the flags I provided, which were read, write, share. Thank you. So this is a mapping which lets me change the file. So the way that works is basically the same as you saw before, but I have to handle writing to this data. And a thing about writing to that data is that if I write to the file with my mapping, it better be eventually written to disk. Otherwise, I'm not actually changing the file, really, right? I'm just temporarily changing it, and then it's going to change back. That's not very nice. So let's say I have this valid mapping here, and I write to the file. So we're going to update the cache data, and the way this is going to work is the OS is going to give me a page table entry that points directly to the cache file data. The same data it's going to access if I call read, the same data other programs might be looking at if they also map the file. So I can write to that, update the cache file data, and now the cache data is the up-to-date version, and the version on disk is out of date. And eventually, we need to fix that. So eventually, we're going to free this memory up, or the system's going to shut down, and we need to write that to disk. And we'd like to not have to write also this and this and this and this to disk. So we need some way of tracking which things have we actually changed. So we need to know for everything, was it modified? And the way we're going to do that is we're going to have what's called a dirty bit. So if you remember from processor caches, if you covered those, we had dirty bits. We're going to do the same thing for pages, that we're going to have a dirty bit, and we're going to usually keep this in page table entries. In x86, the processor does this for us. Every page table entry has a bit labeled D in the diagrams I showed you last time for dirty, which the processor will set when the program tries to write to it. And this occurs as long as that page table entry was used to write. If you used a different page table entry to write, so for example, if you remember in XV6, we had another way in the kernel of accessing every part of memory, you wouldn't notice, unless you check that. If you didn't have a dirty bit, you could still do this. And on some systems, this is what you have to do. There's no hardware support directly for dirty bits. You could just set the page table entry read-only. On a page fault, you realize, oh, it's supposed to be writable. You record that it's dirty somewhere and make it writable. So because I can map a file for multiple processes, that if I have this dirty bit in a page table entry, I might have the same cached file page mapped from multiple processes, or even from the same process. Maybe I call mmap multiple times, and I get different locations for each mapping, but they point to the same cached file. I write to one, I should see it in the other, it's the same page. But if you want to know if it's dirty, you have to check all the page table entries that might have been used. And this is something real OSs do, is that if they want to check if it's dirty for a cached file page, they need to iterate through every single process to find every single page table entry that points to that physical page, see if it's dirty, and if so, no, they need to write it back to disk. Any questions about dirty bits? Yeah.
So when does the operating system perform that check? Like looking through all the
pages? So the question is, when does the operating system do this? So I guess so one case is if you're deallocating a page table entry, you need to check the dirty bits. Is basically the rule. And if you're deallocating a page, a physical page, you have to deallocate all the PTEs. But you also might deallocate a page table entry because like the process goes away. So in all those cases, you need to check the dirty bits because otherwise you might forget that the write happened. Any other questions? Okay, so that's dealing with writes to our shared data. So we have these private mappings too. And I mentioned that the most common, you know, most obvious use case for a private writable mapping was global variables. And that's in fact what we see here. So here, bin cat is mapped to this address range, part of the executable as writable but private. And what they're doing here is that we have the initial values of some global variables that we're loading into memory, and we're loading it as writable so we can change them from the initial values when we write to those global variables. But initially, they're just the values stored in the executable. And the way this works is reads happen like we saw before. Reads work exactly the same way. If we read, we just go directly to the cache file data for bincat. But let's say we write. So we're going to do copy and write, which means that we were going to set all these page table entries read-only, because the assumption is that usually we won't write, or at least we'll wait until we actually write to deal with that. So when we have a write, we say, well, you told me you want a private copy of this file. You don't want me to modify the shared copy that's in blue here. So when that happens, I'm going to make you a private copy and update your page table to point to that. And I can just make a private copy of the parts of the file you actually change. So any questions about this? So a complication with this is that now I need to track even more information. That I need to know, oh, this page here is not part of the original file. I need to know that for later because, for example, I'm going to need to eventually, you know, deallocate that page when no one's referring to it. So there's a bunch of extra bookkeeping involved in this, especially since there's like more complicated cases like what if I fork after doing this? We want to do copy and write. And this is something OSs really handle. But conceptually, it's just you want a private copy, I make it as late as I have to, which is when you actually write, I'm going to make you copy. Yes?
Why do we need the private copy rather than just making the one that's cached writable?
So why don't we just write to this? Because if there's some other process which is working the same way, then I'd be modifying that process's initial global variables. So the idea is that I have two copies of bin cat. They both have their initial global variables in blue. I want it to be that they act as if they have their own copies of it, even though I might have two copies of bin cat running. Okay. Any other questions? So we also see here in this mapping table, it has entries for memory which doesn't correspond to files. So one of these entries here is labeled heap, but it doesn't correspond to any file. It's just memory region that's mapped to not point to any file. And the way Linux tracks memory regions is everything is basically a memmap region. It's just a special case if it doesn't actually go to a file. So the way regions like this work is that typically we have them pointing to some data in memory. We might have some map parts of the area which aren't allocated yet. They're going to work like I showed you earlier, that if you try to access one of those pieces, we're actually going to allocate it on demand. And if you try to access that invalid, the page fault handler is going to say, oh, I remembered, I allocated this space for you earlier. I'm going to make that work by actually allocating the page now and updating your page table entry so it works. So this is basically the same as when we had files, except rather than loading data from disk, we just create a new page and just set it all to zeros instead of loading a new page from disk when you try to access something, because we don't actually have an initial value to load. So one thing is, what if we decide that we're out of space and I want to free up some of your memory here? What do we do? And it seems like right now our only option is that we're going to just get rid of, we're going to say, sorry, you're out of memory. Note that this is different than the case back here, where we can eventually free up some space by writing values back to disk. And it turns out that it would be, you know, kind of convenient if we could decide that we're freeing up some space by writing it back to disk. So what we'll do, we'll in fact do this. We'll just say, okay, I want to free up some of your space, so I'm just going to, even though you didn't specify a file, I'm going to make up a file for you for this data. And I'm going to write it out to that file. So I'm going to invalidate this page and copy it to that file. And I'm sorry, I have the wrong animation here. So I'm just going to send this over here, make your page table entry invalid, save it to disk temporarily. Later on, if you access it, I need to somehow remember, oh, I saved that to disk earlier, here's your data back. So this is called swapping, because doesn't have a location on disk, we give it a location on disk, but this is actually the same thing we do for stuff that's in files. We're just doing it for something where it didn't start in a file, we're just making up a file for it. So we'll also do this, it turns out, for copy on write pages. So here I have my copy on write mapping. So I have some modified data, some normal data that's part of the file. And let's say I'm running out of memory, I need to free up memory. So the first thing that the OS is going to do is it's going to say, oh, I have all this file data that you're not really using. I'm going to start just getting rid of all of that. I'm going to get rid of that. I have a copy on disk. I don't need to do anything. I just get rid of it. I can read it from disk later on if I need it. And when I get rid of it, of course, I make all your page table entries invalid, so you don't attempt to access whatever I'm replacing in memory there that needs all this space. But let's say I need still more memory. Then I'm going to do the same trick I showed you earlier. I'm going to say, oh, you have this copied data. It doesn't have a place I can put it on disk because it's not part of a file. That's okay. I'll make up a file for you. Here you go. Here's your file. Here's your data in that file. And when I've done that, I can mark your page table entry as invalid, and then I can use this physical page for something else, whatever is hogging up all the memory on my system. So any questions about this procedure? So this is the same thing I did, it's the same kind of thing we do as far as freeing up memory to send it to files, except here we just have to make up a new file because we don't have one for this data. In this case, we don't have a file for your private copy. We're making up a file for your private copy. In the original case, there wasn't any file at all. We made up a file for your data to temporarily store it and bring it back. And as part of doing this, we need to remember, where did I put it? Where did I bring it back? But that's a lot less information than the amount of data we saved on disk. So, questions? Okay, so this is called swapping. And this is, in fact, what virtual memory was built for. Like, the design of paging and page tables was originally built because supporting this use case was the big thing, that we wanted memory to really be, you know, subservient to disk, that we'd store all our data on disk. Memory was just a temporary copy that we'd bring in when we needed it and take out when we ran out of space in memory. And one way of looking at this is as another layer of the memory hierarchy, that memory is just a cache for data on disk and SSDs, that we have these mappings to files, either files that we specified or files the OS makes up for us when we allocate memory. And that's really where our data is stored, and the OS just temporarily brings it into memory when it has space to do so, and takes it out when it runs out of space. It updates our page tables to reflect this. And so swapping for, you know, is basically doing this mmap thing, but with default files to use, kind of. So swapping is less attractive today as sort of a strategy than it used to be. And the big reason is that hard drives and solid state disks are slow. That they're like hundreds of microseconds, in the best case, often milliseconds, and you don't want to be doing that every time you touch memory. You don't want to be doing that even one out of a million times you touch memory. Because millisecond is like a million instructions worth of that work. Like, if you do it every a million times you touch memory, we're basically making your program half the speed. If you have to wait to read something from disk every million times you access memory. But the general strategy still persists in modern OSs of treating memory as a cache for disk. And the biggest way this shows up is that files are cached. So for program data, we want it to be in memory when you're running the program. That the only case where it's generally not going to be and your system's not performing really slow is when we're loading something. That when we load, it's initially not in memory. We're going to get it into memory as you're running the program, and, you know, possibly load it at, you know, the first time the program tries to access it. But for files, we're going to keep all the file data in memory, and this is really great for performance. This means that if you like have a big video file, you read it once, you read it again. If you have enough RAM, the OS will just keep it in memory. And in this view, our physical memory is just this data which we're temporarily keeping in memory. Hopefully, it's the important stuff, like stuff programs need to run, like their heaps, and their stacks, and their executable data, and also any files we access frequently. Probably all of that's kept in physical memory, and the physical memory is just copies of the important parts of stuff that we could be keeping on disk. And the OS's goal is just to manage this intelligently. And we'll, for the rest of our time talking about virtual memory, mostly be looking at memory from this view, that what do we decide to keep in memory? How do we manage it as a cache? So this is notably a fully associative cache. We can use any virtual address to refer to any part of a file. We can set up that mapping arbitrarily And the page table says where it is in physical memory. We can put anything anywhere, because we can have any page table entry point to any visible page. There's no restrictions. And notably, these two choices here, this choice here, replacement, is entirely managed by the OS. So if you run out of memory, the OS needs to decide, what do I get rid of? And that's entirely the OS's decision. And we're going to talk a lot about, how do you make that decision? How do you decide, you're reading a file, I need to cache the file in memory for you, where do I put that? What files do I get rid of? Do I get rid of some program stack and save it to disk temporarily? How does the OS make that decision? And that's all the OS's decision. The processor isn't involved. The OS just changes the page tables based on its decision. Whatever it's getting rid of makes that invalid in all the page tables or any other data structures it uses to track, like, files. So we have three components here that are important to managing this. And one of them we've definitely seen, and that's this mapping from virtual address to physical page. And also the mapping from file and offset to physical page. And these are our cache hits. So these mapping, so one of this, virtual address to physical page, that's exactly what the page table is. It's a mapping from here's a virtual address, here's where it is in physical memory. We have a second mapping, which is that we need to know, given a part of a file, where is it? We need to know this, like, for example, if you call read. We need to know, how do I find that data that if I have it in memory already? And that there's going to have to be some kernel data structure to track that. So this page table we've seen, and the structure of the page table is determined by hardware. And this is determined by hardware because the hardware is responsible for the fast case. That when we access memory, the hardware is involved. For everything else we're talking about, it's the OS's choice. If you want to choose where is a page of a file in the file, the OS gets to decide that because the OS is the only one looking that up. The processor is not going to directly look up where in this file is this data, that sort of thing. The OS is the only one who needs to say, here's a file, here's a part of a file, let me read it. So it can decide how it stores that information. So for example, on Linux, this is the subsets of the Linux data structures that do this. Yes, there's a lot more indirection than you think there should be. But Linux has their struct file. This is what goes in the open file table on Linux, which points to a struct inode, which has what's called an address space, which is what they use to represent the cached part of a file, basically. And it has a tree of pages, a balanced, not a binary tree, but a balanced tree of pages. A radix tree. And this is how they find the cache copies of the files that are shared between processes, the ones you access if you map with map shared, or the one you access if you're reading and you want to see, do I have to actually go to disk? So exactly that, the list of those blue pages there. That's one thing the OS needs to keep track of as part of implementing what we call this page cache, that using memory as a cache for disk. So we need to keep track of this for all files. Any questions? Or okay. So another thing we need is we need some way to find the location of something based on a virtual address or a file and offset. And this is for handling cache misses. So if I have a page fault and I discover, oh, oh, I don't have a copy of this in memory, I need to know where do I get it from? And there are two big cases here. So one case is that it's part of a file. If it's part of a file, then I need to know, based on how my file system works, which we'll talk about in over a long period of time, because there's lots of choices there, I need to know, based on how my file system works, where on disk do I read it from? If it's something that I swapped out, where there's not a backend file, but the kernel made one up, I need to have the identity of that made up file. So what we're going to have is we're going to have a data structure saying, what file was this a part of for a virtual address? And based on that, we're going to look up the file. We're going to ask the file system, hey, you know how you organize data on disk. Tell me where I find this data. So on Linux, the way they manage this is that you saw that list of that table of mappings. They have a data structure that represents each entry in that table, and that's what they store. So this process is scanning through the list of these, which have the start and end address. You figure out, oh, you're accessing this virtual address. Let me find the entry where it's in the range between the start and end. And once I find that, I get a pointer to the file and the offset in the file, and I can compute where in the file it is, and I can ask the file system, hey, where do you store this part of this file on disk? And the file system's going to have a method of figuring that out that we'll talk about in a couple weeks. And we also have all the other information we saw, like protection bits and so on. So the other case is when we have swap.data, where there wasn't a file, but we made one up for you. And Linux uses a trick for this, which is pretty common among OSs. And their trick is that they store this location in a page table entry. That they say, well, the page table entry is invalid anyway, so we have all these leftover bits that we're not using, where we'd store a physical page number. We're just going to store a location on disk as a number there. And we'll just have a standard scheme for saying this location on disk, this number goes to this disk, and you just figure out from that. And this, by the way, is why when I showed you the page table entry format, they had this version where if it wasn't present, it was just ignored. That supports doing this trick, which a lot of OSs do. Okay. So another thing we need to do is we need to actually handle when we're taking stuff out or bringing stuff in, we need to handle knowing about what physical page to choose. So when we're allocating a page, we need to know, well, where do I get it from? I want to evict something. What do I evict? If I've chosen to evict something, how do I make that invalid everywhere? So we need to do that. So one thing we need to know is, which thing do I get? And the way Linux does this is that it has a data structure for every physical page. And this seems like it takes up a lot of space, and it does. But it has a data structure for every physical page, and one of the things in that is that every page has a next and previous pointer for a list of least recently used pages. So we just go to the top of that list, we'll get a physical page, and we can go to the next one to find the next page. And hopefully, these are in orders by frequency, by least recently used, so we'll get something which hasn't been used in a long time, and hopefully won't be used again soon, so we're not going to have to load it from disk again when we reuse this physical page. We'll talk later on about what this list actually looks like, because if you're thinking about this, you may say, we can't really maintain a least recently used list, because how do we update the next pointer when someone reads a page? We can't do that. And we can't. Well, I mean, we can, but it's really, really slow. So we aren't going to do that. We'll talk about what we actually do, which is not as good, but pretty good. But we're going to have this list of pages in an order telling us, here's the one I want to use. We'll talk next time about how do we maintain that list in a way which is not completely bad. Where you aren't going to always choose like your stack every time as the page to evict, and then you try to push on your stack and you waste a lot of time. So after we've chosen a page, we need to handle how do we actually get rid of that from memory. And this is a lot of work, it turns out. And the big issue is that we better not have any pointers to that page, which means that there better not be any page table entries pointing to that page. There better not be any files saying, this is still part of my cached file. Because we're using it for something else, we're changing the data, we don't want to read some process's stack when we're trying to read from a file. Just because we decided, oh, I need more space for to find this stack, I'm going to not cache this file anymore. Which means that we need to track every single location a page is used. So we need to have a way of, given this is the physical page I've chosen, looking up every single place that page is referenced. And it could be the case that every single process has that page in its page table entries. And we need to remove it from every single process's page table. So this is one of the most complicated things about many of the memory management infrastructures in real OSs, is dealing with this lookup. This lookup doesn't need to be done very often, we hope, but it's very important to get it right, and you don't want to have to actually manage like a list for every physical page, because if you think about how much space that list might take up, it's like, you know, do you really want to take up like 32 extra bytes for every page or more? Like you want to try to keep it very compact. So the way Linux does this is basically that each page has a pointer to this address space structure, which is part of the file. So each page has a pointer to the file it's a part of, and is offset in the file, and the file has a pointer to everyone who has mmapped the file, and we go through that. So we have lots of indirection here, but this way, when we map a file, we just add to our list of processes which have mapped the file. And when we evict the page, we look at what file is it a part of, who's mapped the file, I look at all those mappings, say, does this include the part of the file I'm getting rid of? It might not, because they might only be mapping like the beginning of the file, and we've cached the end, or vice versa. But we do that lookup every time we need to get rid of a page in order to make sure that no one has a pointer to it. And this is what Linux does for file pages, and this is typical of what an OS will do. They'll have a pointer to what file is this part of, and that pointer exists primarily to support the get rid of all copies of the page operation if I only know the physical page number. So I can only find the struct page based on that. We have like an array of struct pages. The other case is that we have non-file pages. We have those anonymous pages, like our heap, right? Our heap doesn't have a backend file. We'll create one if we need one, but it doesn't have one. So the way Linux handles this, it has a mapping from the page. It has a pointer to a linked list of mmap allocations, those area structs that start, end, file names, file pointer, and so on, for each thing. And why is it a pointer to a list? Well, it's a pointer to a list because of things like fork. That we need to handle fork, having two copies of the heap pages. We still need to track those correctly. So we have a list for everything. And whenever we get rid of a page, we iterate through this list. We also need to update this list, like when we do copy and write. And that is something that is handled. And rather tedious. So we could have had a separate list for each page, and that would be a working solution. Linux just has shares the list between groups of pages just to save some space. But basically, it's just a list for each page. We update the list when we like do something like fork, so we don't have two references to it. Linux actually does this with, you know, separate lists for a group of pages to avoid having lots of copies of the list, which would take up extra space. But it's the same idea as if we had a list for every page. And that's what this thing called non-VMA is a pointer to the current list for this region, basically. This is the list of other, this is where how you figure out who else has a copy of this range of pages. Like, who, if I forked, who else might share pages with me because of this? I'm not talking about the details of the structure of this, and that's on purpose, because I don't think it's terribly important. The important thing is that we have a way of knowing who else might have the same page and share it with me, so I can do this lookup. And the important thing is I can do the lookup from the page to find these and figure out all the related pages. So any questions on this idea? So those are our inverse mappings. So let's talk about page replacement in more detail. This is what we'll be going over a lot next time. Because besides the mechanics, which I'm mostly going to say, you know, we have that reverse mapping, we do some indirection to avoid using lots of space, having like a separate list for each page. But we have that reverse mapping, we assume that's a given. And then we do this operation. So we have our, you know, easy, our eviction step, we evict the stuff. Remove it from every page table, every list of file pages, save it to disk if we need to, which we don't always, but sometimes, depending if it's dirty, any of those page table entries, and we load the data in its place. So that's page replacement, is the process of evicting pages, loading new data to replace that. And we have some goals in this. So one goal is hit rate, that we want to, based on what pages we're evicting, we want to have the fewest cases where we try to read a page and it's not there, we have to load it. So that's hit rate. That's how many times do I try to access a page, it's there. You also hear about throughput, which is performance. And you might say, gosh, isn't that the same as hit rate? No. It's almost the same, but not quite. And one important case you can think of is, what if I'm always writing out dirty pages? That's going to be slower than just getting rid of dirty pages, even if I have the same hit rate. Another thing we might want to care about is some idea of fairness, that we want every process to be get the same share of memory in some sense. And that might conflict with hit rate. So to start out, I'm going to talk about optimizing hit rate. And as I said, hit rate is not quite the same as throughput. So one is things that I mentioned, writing back pages. That takes time, and maybe avoiding that will make you faster, even if you have more cases where you need to load something from disk. Another case is that if I'm creating zero pages versus loading pages from disk might be faster. Like just creating an empty page versus reading it from disk might be faster. You know, so optimizing hit rate doesn't mean I've optimized my performance, but it's a good approximation. So it's what we're going to care about first, but note that there are some other ways we might do that. And that's what we'll talk about next time, is trying to optimize hit rate and make it practical.